Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering shows from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, and there's mystery in this hour. Later on, Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson star in The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, but right now, J. Scott Smart is the Fat Man, one of the very few broadcasts remaining from this series. From January 2nd, 1948 on ABC, it's Murder Plays Hide and Seek.
There he goes, into that drugstore. He's stepping on the scale. Weight, 237 pounds. Fortune, danger. Who is it?
The Fat Man.
The Norwich Pharmacal Company, makers of Pepto-Bismol, unguentine, and other fine drug products, brings you the adventures of Dashiell Hammett's fascinating and exciting character, the Fat Man, a fast-moving criminologist who tips the scales at 237 pounds. Tonight's adventure, starring J. Scott Smart in Murder Plays Hide and Seek. And now, from New York, Pepto-Bismol brings you the Fat Man.
The housing shortage may be bad, but there's one place I know of that always has room for another tenant. It's a big gray structure near the river, and the windows are crossed with iron bars, and the landlord never asks you for a penny in rent. If you're an extra special customer, they even give you a private suite in a secluded part of the building that leads directly to a room with a heavy chair. That room is reserved for the guys who find out that they can't get away with murder.
The Fat Man learned his business the hard way. But there's an easy way to care for an upset stomach. Just don't overdose with antacids or physics. Instead, take Pepto-Bismol. Now, the Fat Man in Murder Plays Hide and Seek.
Inasmuch as eating is one habit I find very hard to break, I usually prefer my clients to have enough cash to pay for my work. In Andy Maroney's case, however, I made an exception to the rule. I've known Andy for quite a while, and I can guess what he earns driving that hack of his around from dusk to dawn. With a wife and three kids, you can't afford any fancy fees for a private detective. It was almost 3 a.m. when Andy knocked on my apartment door.
All right. All right. Keep your shirt on. I'm coming. Who is it?
It's Andy Maroney, Mr. Runyon. The hacky.
Well, what's on your mind, Andy?
I didn't do it. I swear I didn't do it. You gotta help me, see?
Now take it easy, Andy.
I thought he was drunk when she asked me to take him home. I had nothing to do with it, Mr. Runyon, so help me.
Now, will you calm down long enough to make some sense?
I'm talking about the stiff. The guy who was croaked.
What guy? Where is he?
Downstairs, in the back of my cab. For the love of Mike, will you hurry?
Well, do you mind if I put some clothes on?
I'll lose my license. I'll lose my job, and they'll put me in the cooler for 160 years.
Here, hand me those shoes.
You're a right guy, Mr. Runyon. Every hacky knows you're okay. You help me out of this, and I'll pay you back if it takes the rest of my life.
Well, it's too long to wait. Put this one on the house. There we are. Now I'll get my coat, and we'll be off. Okay, come on.
I got the hack parked in the front of the door. As soon as I saw the guy was dead, I made a beeline for your flat. I figured I could explain it better to you than I could to the cops.
You ever see him before?
No. He was sitting in the back of my cab when I came out of the beanery. I only left the car parked for about 20 minutes while I got some sinkers and some java. A blonde dame standing by the cab handed me $5 to take him home, so I figured he was drunk.
Here, out this way.
There's a hack. He's flopped over in the rear seat.
What is this, Andy? A corny gag?
Holy smoke. The stiff is gone.
You must have been dreaming.
He was there, I tell you, on the level. He was sitting there in the back 5 minutes ago.
How do you know he was dead?
Because I shook him. I felt his pulse. There was blood coming out of his mouth.
Hey, wait a minute. What's this on the floor?
It's his hat. That's the hat the guy was wearing.
His initials are on the sweatband, CH. Where were you taking him, Andy? Did this blonde give you his address?
Yeah, but it turned out to be a phony. That's when I found out he was dead. I thought he'd passed out, and I tried to shake him into giving me his right house number.
Would you recognize the woman if you saw her again?
In a minute. She was a tall job, easy on the eyes. She was standing on the sidewalk next to my hack, wearing an evening gown.
You mean without a coat in this weather?
Well, come to think of it, she didn't have a coat.
Come on, get into this jalopy and let's get started.
Where are we going?
Back to the corner where you met your customer.
This is it, Mr. Runyon.
Yeah. What's that joint over there? Nightclub?
Yeah, the Venetian Blind. It's a fancy dump that gets the Ehrman crowd.
Well, if that blonde wasn't wearing a coat, she must have come out of there.
Well, it's almost 4 o'clock. The joint must be closed.
Well, we'll try it anyway.
Yeah, it's closed up like I said.
See anything through the glass in the door?
There's a light on in the hall. Oh, wait a minute. A dame's coming out. No, it ain't the same one.
Oh, good evening.
I'm sorry. The club is closed for the night.
You work in here, miss?
Yes, I do.
This isn't a pickup. I'm just looking for information. Did you happen to see a good-looking, tall, blonde woman?
She was wearing a silver evening dress an hour ago.
That sounds like Mrs. Rogers, the owner.
Is she inside?
Yes, I think so. What are you, a policeman?
What gives you that impression?
You act like one.
My name is Runyon. I'm a private detective. I've got a little business with your boss.
She's in her office, I imagine. Come inside and I'll show you where it is.
Thanks. Is everybody else going home for the night?
I guess so. I'm Peggy Dale. I sing with the orchestra.
Hey, Peggy!
Oh, I thought you'd gone, Frank.
I was waiting for you, baby. I hope maybe I could take you home. Who's this?
He's a private detective. His name is Runyon.
What's the matter? Something wrong?
That all depends. Who are you?
Frank Coley. I handle the drums in the band. What's up?
We're looking for a stolen corpse.
You what?
Do you two happen to know anyone with the initials C.H.?
Not me.
I know a woman named Hunt. Clarissa Hunt.
This particular C.H. is a man.
There she is, Mr. Runyon.
It's Mrs. Rogers.
What's going on here?
Are you sure she's the woman who handed you the fiver, Andy?
Positive, Mr. Runyon. You remember me, lady?
No.
Sure you remember. You asked me to take that drug home, and you gave me a 5-spot to do it.
I never saw you before in my life.
It's a frame. She's lying, I tell you.
Relax, Andy. Mrs. Rogers, you wouldn't be holding out on us by any chance, huh?
I don't know what you're talking about.
That drunk that Andy chauffeured for was dead. You wouldn't like to be mixed up in a murder rap, would you?
No.
Then how about a few details?
I don't know anything about a drunk or a dead man. I never saw this moron before.
Listen, you double-crossing hen. I ain't taking it in the neck for nobody.
Pipe down, Andy.
Mr. Runyon.
What's the matter?
Look, under that drape, near the window.
There's a guy's feet sticking out.
Stay where you are now, all three of you.
What? It's Charlie Haney.
And he's dead. Well, it looks like we've found our body, Andy.
Well, wait a minute, Mr. Runyon. That ain't the same guy who was in my cab.
Two hours later, I was in Lieutenant McKenzie's office at headquarters. The dawn was just about breaking, and I listened to Mac's autopsy report as I sipped a welcome container of steaming coffee.
Charlie Haney was poisoned, Brad. Stuff was slipped into a drink.
What about the blood on his mouth?
Poison they used was dynamite. Brought on a hemorrhage.
The guy in Andy's cab got his walking papers in the exact same way.
I don't know. I'm inclined to think that Charlie Haney and the guy in Maroney's hack were one and the same.
Why? Because the initials in the hat?
That's one reason. And Maroney admitted the back of his cab was dark when he looked at his passenger.
He scared Mac. He'll admit almost anything if he thought he'd save you a little trouble. Now, personally, I think we're dealing with two different killings, and both the victims have the same initials.
Then what happened to corpse number one?
Well, it's a cinch he didn't walk to a funeral partner to get himself registered.
Well, I questioned the girl, the musician, and Mrs. Rogers.
You got any dope?
Not much. Charlie Haney was a jack-of-all-trades around the Venetian blind. Did odd jobs for Mrs. Rogers. Sometimes he'd throw out an obstreperous customer.
A bouncer, huh?
He was big enough.
Yeah, I say he was.
Well, in any case, I had nothing on him, so I let him loose. I might have held Mrs. Rogers on suspicion, but her battery of lawyers would have sprung her anyway.
What about Andy Maroney?
Well, he's in the clear so far. I'm letting him go back to his cab, but I'm padlocking the Venetian blind while the investigation goes on.
If you don't mind my saying so, Mac, that isn't a very smart move.
No? Why?
I think you'd be better off to keep the club open and give the killer a chance to show up again.
Look, Brad, I'm going to ask you for a favor.
Okay, shoot.
Lay off this case.
Why?
Well, first of all, your client's in the clear, so that's taken care of.
And secondly?
I won't buy your theory about two victims. And it's the kind of a thing that might confuse the investigation.
Sensitive, Mac?
Now, you know better than that. I'm just saying that your guesswork is cockeyed. And I'm going to have enough trouble solving the murder of one victim without searching for an imaginary corpse. Hello? Yes, Mackenzie speaking. What? Oh. Yeah, I'll be right over. Here, Brad. Have a cigar.
You look as if you're giving away a prize.
I am. One of the motorcycle squad just picked up a dead man under the Queensborough Bridge. The initials on his wallet were C.H.
I rode over to the Queensborough Bridge with Mackenzie and saw the body. It was identified by Andy as the guy he'd had in his cab. And a card in his wallet gave his name as Casper Hall. They took him back to the morgue for an autopsy, but I was pretty sure of what they'd find. So I drove back to my apartment to catch up with a few hours of sleep. It must have been 11 or 11:30 in the morning when I found myself with another guest. And this one was just as unexpected as the last. Yeah, just a second. One of these days, I'm liable to get myself some sleep.
Good morning, Mr. Runyon.
Well, good morning. Come in.
Thanks.
I'm sorry the room's in such a mess. I wasn't expecting company.
That's all right.
You're the gal I saw last night, the gal that sings the Venetian blind.
That's right, Peggy Dale.
Cigarette, Peggy?
No, thank you.
Where are you going?
I want to look out the window. I had a feeling I was being followed.
Anybody there?
Street's empty.
What's on your mind, sweetheart?
Before I tell you anything, I want to be sure you won't tell anybody I told you.
Oh, is it that hot?
It might be.
Okay, I'll play ball. Let's have it.
They're holding Mrs. Rogers at headquarters now.
Are they? Again?
When they found the man named Casper Hall, they took that taxi driver's word against hers about putting him into the cab.
Oh, yeah?
I was there when they questioned Mrs. Rogers. They questioned me as well. She finally admitted putting Hall into the cab. And her excuse was that she thought he was a drunk and she wanted to get rid of him so he wouldn't raise a fuss.
Well, that sounds logical to me.
But one thing she didn't tell them.
What's that?
That she'd seen and talked to Casper Hall before.
You knew that?
He's been in the Venetian blind a dozen times. And I've seen him at the same table with Mrs. Rogers.
Did you tell that to the lieutenant?
No.
Why not?
Because Mrs. Rogers would have heard me. I'm scared of her, Mr. Runyon. She's hard and she's mean. It's not only my job. I didn't want to end up the way poor Charlie did.
Well, I can't blame you for that.
She's been mixed up with gangsters and racketeers ever since she went into the nightclub business. I've seen some of them at the blind.
So you decided to spill the beans to me, hmm?
You can tell the lieutenant, but I don't want any part of it.
Okay, Peggy. Thanks for calling. Oh, by the way, is Mackenzie padlocking the club?
No. He was going to, but he changed his mind.
Will you be there tonight?
I guess so. Why?
I just wanted to ask you to save me a ringside table. The Venetian blind seems to have the most interesting floor show in town. I checked with McKenzie and gave him the dope, but he couldn't hang on to Mrs. Rogers. He didn't have enough evidence to get an indictment yet. That meant Mrs. Rogers would be back in her club that night, and so would I. I got in touch with Andy Maroney, who showed up at my flat about 10, just as I was putting the finishing touches to the soup and fish. Sit down, Andy. Be with you in a minute.
Say, you look pretty slick in that outfit, Mr. Runyon.
Well, you said the Venetian blind catered to the Ehrman crowd, so I decided to get the dinner jacket out of mothballs.
You know, I was just thinking.
Yeah, what?
My uncle.
Yeah? What about your uncle?
He was buried in an outfit like that.
Stop being so cheerful. I intend to wear it vertically.
You want me to drive you over?
Yeah, that's why I called. There's something else I want you to do.
Anything you say.
When I go into that club, I want you to park outside and keep your eyes open. If I'm not out of there within 2 hours, get a hold of the police.
Expecting trouble?
I'm not expecting it, Andy. I'm looking forward to it. It had started to snow when we got down to the street. The night was crisp and cold. If I hadn't been so busy admiring the weather, I might have noticed that Andy's hack, which was standing in front of the door, was occupied once again.
Hello, Mr. Runyon.
Oh, what are you doing here, Cooley?
I want to talk to you.
Okay, move over. Drive straight to the Venetian blind, Andy.
Right. Don't drive to the blind. Let's go in the other direction.
Say, who's giving the orders around here?
I am.
Hey, he's got a gun.
Drive in the other direction, Andy, as the gentleman requests. I'd put that gun away, Frankie. Drums are safer to fool with.
I'll put it away when I'm good and ready.
Suit yourself.
And I'll be ready when I put a slug in you.
Been drinking?
That's none of your business.
Funny how a pint of booze makes a lion out of a mouse.
I'll show you who's a mouse when we get out of town, fat man.
Mr. Runyon.
Keep driving, Andy.
Yeah, yeah. Keep on driving. Unless you want the top of your head opened up for ventilation.
Before you start popping that cannon, I hope you'll explain why you picked me for a target.
You know why.
Well, do I?
You should have had sense enough to keep out of this. You Weisenheimered yourself right onto a slab.
Who are you covering for, Frankie? Yourself?
Never mind the questions.
Because up to now, it was Mrs. Rogers who held my interest.
Mrs. Rogers?
Yeah. If you're covering for her, you're just wasting your time. By tomorrow morning, we'll have enough on your boss to get an indictment.
You're pretty sure of yourself, aren't you?
Well, I was until you shoved that rod in my rib. Now I'm beginning to change my mind.
Yeah, so am I.
Really?
Stop this cab, mister.
There are lots of people in this section, Cooley. You're not going to risk any fireworks in a spot like this, are you?
Keep driving and don't look back. Go on, beat it.
Gee, for a minute I thought he was going to knock the two of us off.
And so did I. But instead he gave me a brand new angle.
There's a cop on the corner. Do you want to make a report?
Forget it. I may have a much more interesting report to make to the cops later on. It was almost 11 when we got to the Venetian blind. The place was pretty well crowded. The customers were dressed to kill, and most of the gals were flashing diamonds. Marcia Rogers' sucker list would have matched the social register. Instead of taking a table, I sat at the bar where the view was better. The floor show wasn't the only thing I wanted to see. Give me a rum and Coca-Cola.
And you can put it on the house, Pete.
Thanks, but I like to buy my own.
I had a feeling you'd be back here tonight, fat man. I would have been disappointed if you didn't show.
You do a good business, don't you, Mrs. Rogers?
Not bad.
Found any corpses tonight?
Now, don't start trying to be funny. You're liable to find you've outstayed your welcome.
Still in your silver gown, huh? I thought you'd be wearing black.
For whom?
Casper Hall.
Casper didn't mean anything to me.
That's something you might have to prove. I was informed he spent a lot of time here.
So do my other customers.
Yeah, but they don't usually get picked up cold under the Queensborough Bridge.
The cops haven't got anything on me. They don't even have enough to close up my club.
That's where you're mistaken, Marcia.
Then why didn't they shut me up?
Because I asked them not to.
You?
Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not getting philanthropic.
Then what's the big idea?
Well, maybe I like your entertainment. Oh, by the way, where's your regular drummer?
Cooley?
Yeah.
He quit.
Why?
Don't ask me. When a musician wants to leave, I don't call the FBI and check up on him.
I have a little surprise for you, sweetheart.
Have you?
I think I got this double murder partially solved.
You're a very smart boy.
When Casper Hall was poisoned, the killer didn't expect him to leave the club so soon. After he was helped out, Charlie Haney, your bouncer, was sent after his body.
What did he want the body for, a souvenir?
There must have been something Hall was carrying that the killer wanted. Charlie couldn't frisk him fast enough while he lay in the cab, so he snatched the body and ditched it under the bridge.
Then who killed Charlie Haney?
The one who killed Casper Hall. Charlie knew too much. He was just dumb enough to stick his neck out.
Then why don't you make an arrest?
Well, because I haven't put my hand on the murderer yet. How would you like to set yourself up for the candidate?
You're crazy.
You knew he was dying when you helped him into that cab. And don't hand me that drunk story. It doesn't gel.
I thought you said Casper got out of here too fast. Would I have pushed him into a cab and then sent Charlie after him?
No. That's why I'm crossing you off my list. But I still think you're holding out. And in case you don't know it, baby, an accomplice sits right on top of the killer's lap when they give him the chair.
Why should I hold out?
That's not the $64 question, sweetheart. The point is, why didn't you yell for the cops in the first place when you found Casper Hall 5 minutes from the grave? You want me to tell you why?
Yes.
Casper must have given you something when you put him in that cab. He gave you what the killer wanted and what Charlie Haney was sent out to get. Well, baby, how am I doing?
You're doing fine. Come with me.
She took me to her office without another word, and I had the feeling my bluff was paying off in spades. The theory was a good one, and it accounted for everything that happened, but I couldn't prove it in 100 years if she'd wanted to call me on it. The office was dark when I opened the door, but I caught the sound of someone bumping into a chair as I stepped inside. Stand still, Mrs. Rogers. There's someone in this room, and I'm telling that someone now that I'll shoot to kill if I see anything move when the lights go on. Snap the switch, Mrs. Rogers.
Peggy!
I was just...
She's trying to get at my safe.
That's not true.
What do you got in your safe that's so important, Mrs. Rogers?
I'll show you in just a minute.
Now stand right there, Peggy, like a nice little girl.
Here, this is what Casper Hall gave me the night he died. There's slips of paper in this envelope, written in longhand. In the last few months, 6 of my customers were robbed after they left my place. Their names are on those slips. They were all held up after on their way home, and the police never found the gunman.
There's more than just a name on each piece of paper. There's a description of a car, the license number, an address, and a list of jewelry.
Casper Hall was tipped off whenever an important customer made a reservation. Those women used to come here loaded with jewelry. Someone must have gotten the information beforehand and then handed it to Casper outside on those strips of paper. Then all he had to do was follow the right car.
Would you know who that someone is, Peggy?
No.
Oh, now don't be coy, sweetheart. I had you tagged when your drummer boy, Frankie Cooley, wanted to take me for a ride. He was crazy enough about you to commit murder and keep you in the clear, Peggy. But he changed his mind when I told him I was after Mrs. Rogers.
Give me that envelope.
Oh, no, not so fast, baby. I'll need this myself for a while. We're going to do a little handwriting analysis.
He crossed me. The rat held out. And he used those slips like a club over my head.
That kind of an argument ought to make a big hit with a jury. Mrs. Rogers, why didn't you hand those slips over to the police?
I only held those slips for one reason. If the thing leaked out before you grabbed the killer, I'd have been ruined. No one would have come here anymore. They'd all been scared to death.
Didn't Casper tell you who gave him the slips?
Casper couldn't talk when I helped him out and put him in that cab. All he could do was push that envelope in my hand. I was frightened, and I only wanted to get rid of him in a hurry.
Uh-huh. Well, I got to hand it to you, Peggy. You certainly must have what it takes.
Drop dead, fat man.
Knowing you were going to kill Charlie Haney because he knew too much, you charmed him into frisking a corpse. Then you sicked Frank Cooley on me with a rod in his hand. But you're going to run into one guy who won't fall for the pretty dimple, sweetheart. The public executioner at Sing Sing.
The fat man returns in a moment. It's a shame to let an upset stomach interfere with your work or your fun. And it needn't if you keep a bottle of Pepto-Bismol in your medicine chest. Next week, Pepto-Bismol presents Dashiell Hammett's exciting character, the Fat Man, in the adventure called Murder Finds a Decoy. And now, a word from the Fat Man.
Ever since the beginning of time, the female of the species has been beguiling the male with her charms. And the male, since the beginning of time, has been falling into the trap quite willingly. But both male and female are most unwilling victims when murder finds a decoy.
Tonight's Adventure of the Fat Man, starring J. Scott Smart, was written by Lawrence Klee and directed by Clark Andrews. Music is under the direction of Bernard Green. Heard tonight were Helen Flint as Marcia and Joe Harding as Andy. Remember, when your stomach's upset, don't add to the upset. Take soothing Pepto-Bismol and feel good again. Charles Irving speaking. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
The Fat Man, on Tuned to Yesterday from January 2nd, 1948 on ABC. You're listening to An Hour of Mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. From July of 1891 through June of 1892, the Strand magazine in England published the tales of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Late in the year of 1892, a collection of his stories was published, including the tales A Scandal in Bohemia, The Adventure of the Red-Headed League, and The Adventure of the Speckled Band, also a case of identity, of which this next broadcast of Sherlock Holmes is based. Heard on January 23, 1955 on NBC, it's called The Tragedy of the Gasfitter's Ball.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The original and immortal stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized anew, with Sir Ralph Richardson as Dr. Watson and Sir John Gielgud in the role of Sherlock Holmes. And now, the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, with Sir John Gielgud as Sherlock Holmes and Sir Ralph Richardson as our storyteller, Dr. James Watson.
I want to tell you this humble tale of poor Miss Sutherland, of the Duchess of Devonshire hat and the grey feather boa. Holmes solved her problem by sheer deduction, without moving once from Baker Street. So now I ask you to come back with me to those old chambers of ours on an early spring evening long ago, when we sat smoking contentedly together on either side of a cheerful fire. What is it, Holmes? What are you looking at?
A client, if I'm not mistaken, Watson. There, do you see her down there in the street, coming up towards our front door?
What, the young woman with the big hat?
Fidgeting nervously on the pavement. I've seen those symptoms before.
And what does fidgeting on the pavement mean, pray?
Usually an affaire du coeur, Watson. She'd like some advice, no doubt, but she isn't now quite sure that the matter isn't rather too delicate for her to reveal, after all. Ah, but now she plunges like a swimmer leaving the bank.
Oh, my soul, you really are impossible. I suppose you can find some further inference from the very ringing of the bell.
Of course. Even there one may discriminate. A bell may be rung in 100 different ways. On this occasion, we may take it that there is a love matter, but that that somewhat sizable maiden isn't so much angry as perplexed or grieved.
Holmes.
Will you kindly admit her, my dear fellow, and then we can resolve our doubts.
Of course. I'm all eagerness.
Good evening. May I see Mr. Sherlock Holmes, sir?
Yes, yes, certainly. And the name, please?
Miss Mary Sutherland.
Oh, come in, Miss Sutherland. This is Mr. Holmes. I am his friend and partner. Miss Mary Sutherland, Holmes.
Ah, Miss Sutherland, good evening. Do sit down.
Good evening.
Don't you find that with your short sight, it's a little trying to do so much typewriting?
Well, I did at first, sir, but I got... Mr. Holmes, you must have heard of me. How did you know that?
It's my business to know things. Otherwise, why should you come to consult me? This gentleman here is Dr. Watson, by the by. You can rely entirely upon his discretion.
Thank you, sir. You see, I came because I'd heard of you, Mr. Holmes. I knew you helped people who were in trouble.
And what trouble are you in, Miss Sutherland?
Oh, sir. I'd give anything if you could solve it for me. I'm not rich, Mr. Holmes, but I've still got $100 or $200 in my own right. I'd give it all to know what's become of Mr. Angel.
We can discuss the financial aspect later, Miss Sutherland. But tell me, why did you come away to consult me in such a very great hurry?
What? You know that too, Mr. Holmes.
No doubt Dr. Watson understands how I know it, eh, Watson?
Oh, Holmes, don't rub it in. Now, I gather it's true, Miss Sutherland?
Yes, sir. I did bang out of the house, rather. Mr. Windibank took it all that easy somehow. Wouldn't go to the police or anything. So I just donned my things and came right away to you, Mr. Holmes.
Mr. Windibank, you said?
Yes. He's my father.
Surely your stepfather, Miss Sutherland, since the name's different.
That's right. Seems funny, don't it? Because I call him Father, and he's only really 5 years older than I am.
Indeed. And your mother's still alive.
Oh, yes. Of course, I don't mind saying, Mr. Holmes, that I wasn't best pleased when she married again, particularly so soon after Father's death, and the man that was nearly 15 years younger than she was.
You mentioned having a little income of your own.
My Uncle Ned in Auckland left it me. It's in stock or some such, and I can only touch the interest. Which is about $100 a year.
A gratifying sum for a single girl, Miss Sutherland.
Well, Mr. Holmes, I really don't feel I need it much, you know. So I let Mr. Windibank, that's Father, I let him draw it for me, and he gives some of it to Mother and keeps the rest. Kind of makes me feel I'm not a drain on them living at home. Mm-hmm. I can make my tuppence a sheet for my typewriting, see?
Quite so.
But, Mr. Holmes, I'm so worried. If only you could help me find Mr. Angel.
Well, let's first hear all about his disappearance. What is his full name, may I ask?
Hosmer Angel. I used to think it was such a nice name. You see, I met him at the gas fitter's ball.
Miss Sutherland, may I?
Oh, Mr. Angel. Again? It's the sixth dance you've asked me for, Mr. Angel.
Maybe I might ask for another one, too, before it's done, Miss Sutherland. Maybe another two.
There only are another two, Mr. Angel.
Well, then. Maybe I might even... call on you tomorrow, Miss Sutherland.
Oh, Mr. Angel.
Couldn't you call me Hosmer?
Hosmer?
Mary. Lovely floor, Mary.
Lovely, Hosmer.
Lovely band, Mary.
Lovely, Hosmer. I wish it could go on and on forever, Hosmer. Just on forever. On and on.
And in a kind of way it did, you see, Mr. Holmes. Because I used to meet him for walks in the dark evenings. And we'd talk and talk about the ball and the way he'd taken me for all those dances.
Most interesting, I'm sure. And when your stepfather came back from France...
Well, it had to end then, of course, because father didn't like young men at the house. But then he went away again, you see. Ah. So Hosmer used to come as before.
And did he write to you in the intervals?
Oh, yes. And so did I. I brought his letters with me, Mr. Holmes. There you are. I thought you might manage to find one of your famous clues in them.
Well, I've no doubt I may, Miss Sutherland. Thank you so much. And then?
He asked me to marry him, Mr. Holmes.
Aha. With your stepfather's consent, of course, Miss Sutherland.
Oh, no, sir. Mr. Windibank would never have given it. After he'd gone to France, Hosmer came to the house one night in dreadful earnest and made me swear with my hands on the testament that I'd always be true to him, whatever happened. He said, could we be married before Father came back from his latest trip? And I said, yes. And Mother was all right, too. She was on our side, and so...
Well, Miss Sutherland?
It was all arranged for last Friday. Very quietly at St. Saviour's near King's Cross. Oh, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, now, please, please, calm yourself, Miss Sutherland. Watson, your handkerchief, perhaps, if you'd be so good.
Yes. There you are, my dear. There.
Thank you, gentlemen. You're very kind. You see, Hosmer came to Mother and me in a hansom, and he put us both into it. Then he got into a four-wheeler, because it was the only other cab in the street. And when we got to the church, Mr. Holmes...
The cab was empty.
Mr. Holmes, how did you guess? Oh, it's true, Doctor. He just disappeared.
Poor heavens.
And I've never seen him since. I'm so afraid for him.
Seems to me that you've been most shamefully treated, Miss Sutherland.
Oh, no, sir, no. Hosmer was good and kind. Something dreadful's happened to him. I know he'd never forsake me of his own will. You must find him, Mr. Holmes.
Well, I'll do my best, Miss Sutherland. I'll most certainly do my very best. You can let me have a description of Mr. Angel, can't you?
I put an advertisement in the papers the other day. There it is, Mr. Holmes. You'll find it there.
Ah, yes, thank you. Dark whiskers, unusually soft voice.
He'd had the quinsy when he was young, and it left him with a weak throat.
I see. And his address?
I never knew it.
Oh. What about the letters you exchanged?
I used to write to the post office in Leadenhall Street, marked to be called for.
Ah, and his letters to you are unheaded, I see. Very well, Miss Sutherland. You've made your statement very well, very clearly, and I shall certainly do all I possibly can for you. You'll leave me your address, won't you, so that I can get in touch with you?
Oh, here it is, sir. In my bag. I wrote it down before I left.
Splendid.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. You've been so kind.
Not at all.
Good day, sir. Good day, Dr. Watson.
Good day, my dear. Oh, Holmes. What a sad story. Have you a theory?
No doubt I shall have, Watson. We must think. Will you have a pinch of snuff?
Huh? Oh, thanks. I say, what a magnificent box. Old gold with an amethyst.
Yes. Oh, of course, I forgot to tell you, Watson. It arrived this morning by special messenger while you were out. A little souvenir from the King of Bohemia, in return for my assistance in the case of the Irene Adler papers.
Oh, so. From the glories of Bohemia to the gas fitter's ball, from the courts of Europe to poor Mary Sutherland.
Poor Mary Sutherland. Yes, poor indeed, my dear Watson. Once long ago, at the time when we first met, in the Milverton case, I said I think that there were crimes that weren't crimes in any recognized sense.
What, is this one of them? You mean you've solved it, Holmes?
Well, I have a glimmering, at least. A glimmering, my dear fellow. Pass me my violin, will you? It only remains to think for a little, Watson. It only remains to think.
Capital snuff, this capital.
Bless you, my dear fellow.
I had, as it happened, a professional case of my own of some gravity at the time, and I had to spend all that night and all the next day at the bedside of my patient. But I confess that during the long, dark watches, my thoughts went back and back to Miss Sutherland and her problem. For all the preposterous hat and the vacuous face
has been something rather touching in the simple faith of that unusual visitor of ours. At last, however, I found myself free with my patient out of danger. I hurried to Baker Street. There was Holmes, half asleep in his armchair and half invisible through the fumes from his pipe. A formidable array of bottles and test tubes told me that he'd spent the day in one of the chemical experiments that was so dear to him.
Well, well, my dear Holmes. Wake up, old fellow. Have you solved it?
Hey, what? Oh, it's you, Watson. What's the matter?
Well, I mean the mystery, Holmes. Miss Sutherland.
Well, oh, sit down. Sit down, my dear Watson. You seem quite agitated.
Well, it's absurd, I know, but I just can't get that girl out of my mind, poor thing. Such an idiotic problem, somehow.
It was never a problem at all, my dear fellow. You'll find a parallel case in Andover in 77 if you consult my index, and there was something of the same sort at The Hague only last year. The idea is really quite old, you know.
Well, I'll confess it's new to me, at least, whatever it is.
Well, it has one or two unusual features, perhaps, which aren't without interest. Oh, I'm awake now. I'm sorry. Pour yourself some whiskey and soda, my dear Watson. And let me give you a little lesson in observation while we're waiting.
Waiting? For what? For whom?
For someone who may help us to lay our hands on that missing Hosmer Angel. The only drawback is that even when we do find him, I'm afraid there isn't any law that can touch the scoundrel.
What puzzles me were his motives. The girl said herself there was no question of money. If he'd even married her first and then deserted her, I'd have understood it better.
You seem to be singularly interested in the technique of matrimonial desertion, my dear Watson.
My dear fellow, I'm only intrigued by the mystery.
Quite so. Yes, you might pour me a whiskey too, will you?
Oh, sorry.
We must take first things first, Watson. We must consider the fair damsel in some detail.
Well, I did try to notice one or two things about her.
Excellent. For example?
Well, one of her gloves was worn through at the right forefinger, for instance. And they'd been good gloves to start with. So I guessed that she was fairly well-to-do in a kind of jolly, easy-going way, a bit careless and so forth. I mean, before she told us about her 100 a year.
Admirable. You progress, Watson. Nothing else about the worn glove?
No, I can't say there was particularly. Oh, but I did see the little dents of the parsley marks on either side of her nose. I wasn't quite as surprised as she was when you told her she was short-sighted.
Splendid, splendid, my dear fellow. And the typewriting, of course, and the fact that she'd come to see us in a great hurry, you perceived all that naturally.
No, not a bit of it. You had me there, I'm afraid.
Ah, well then let me give you a golden hint, Watson. Always look at a woman's sleeve first. With a man, it's perhaps better to take the knees of his trousers.
Ah, but I did look at her sleeve, a kind of purple plush.
Exactly, and there's hardly a better material for showing traces. The double line a little above the wrist was most beautifully defined, just where the typist presses against the table, of course.
Oh, come, Holmes. There must be dozens of other activities where the same thing happens.
What, for instance?
Well, a sewing machine, say, of the hand type.
Well done. That leaves an exactly similar mark, but only on the left arm, my dear fellow, and on the side of it furthest from the thumb, not right across the broadest part, as it was in this case.
All right, you win. But the hurry she'd come in.
After the sleeve, the boots, Watson.
Well, I did glance at her feet.
Yes, to consider the trim turn of her ankle, no doubt. Whereas I observed that her boots, although very similar, didn't match. And that one was buttoned only in the two lower buttons out of the five, and the other only at the first, third, and fifth, showing plainly
that she dressed quickly, except that it could also illustrate my own point from the gloves, that she was easygoing and careless.
The gloves concerned the haste, not the carelessness. What you didn't notice, Watson, was that both the glove and the finger through it were slightly stained with violet ink. So she'd written something before leaving home, but after being fully dressed to go out. She'd written in a hurry and dipped her pen too deep, and it must indeed have been on this very morning, or else the mark wouldn't have been so clear.
Ah, that was the address she wrote down and gave us from her bag.
Exactly.
Well, I give you best again, Holmes.
Thank you. It was all quite elementary. You know, you're really an excellent fellow, Watson.
Indeed, and why, pray?
Why, to put up with me as you do when I'm so unbearably priggish.
Well, let's get back to the missing bridegroom, Holmes.
The redoubtable Hosmer Angel. Very well, then. And about him, Watson.
Well?
I'm afraid I can tell you practically nothing at all,
beyond what you can read yourself from the girl's description in the advertisement and from what his own letters imply.
The description's commonplace enough.
It isn't without some points of interest, however. Just read it.
About 5'7". Bushy black side whiskers. Moustache. Tinted glasses. Unusually soft voice. Hardly much there, I'd say.
And the letters to Miss Sutherland.
Singularly trite in sentiment.
Except that he quotes Balzac once. Anything else?
Oh. Well, they're typewritten.
Splendid, Watson, which in itself is hardly notable, perhaps, except that...
The signature's typewritten, too. Mm. Now, that is strange.
Just so. And here, if I'm not mistaken, is the visitor I was expecting.
Not Hosmer Angel himself, Holmes.
James Windibank, the girl's father, Watson. Or rather, stepfather. It's always as well to do business with male relatives in cases like this. I wrote to him immediately and had a reply to say that he'd call on us at 6:30 this evening. Will you kindly let him in?
Yes, yes, of course.
Shall I describe him to you, Watson, before he knocks?
But how can you? You've never seen him.
Nevertheless, you will find him tallish, clean-shaven, somewhat loud-voiced, and with a pair of wonderfully penetrating eyes. You'll see, Watson. Here he comes. Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Good. Hep.
Come in, Mr. Windibank. My colleague here, Dr. Watson, seems a little stunned by your appearance. I really can't think why.
Well, Watson, I think it's a bit thick, Mr. Holmes. I really can't apologize, see?
Why, what for, Mr. Windibank? Do sit down, won't
you? Oh, that girl and my stepdaughter troubling you with all this.
On the contrary, it's been no trouble at all.
Well, Mary's very excitable and impulsive, see? She would come to you.
Well, why not? It's what I'm here for.
Well, it's nice to have these family troubles made public, you know. Besides, it's just a useless expense. How could you possibly find this scoundrel, Hosmer Angel?
But I have every reason to believe that I have found him, Mr. Windibank.
What? I'm delighted to hear it.
I thought you would be. Watson, do come and join us. Sit down, my dear fellow. Don't stand staring there now. Let me tell you both a little story.
A story, Holmes?
A fairy story. Prefaced by some remarks, perhaps, on the typewriter and its relationship to crime.
Look here, what's all this about?
Now, no two typewriters are quite alike, you know, Mr. Windibank. They are, in fact, as distinctive as handwriting to the expert eye. Now, in these groups of letters I have before me, you'll notice the broken E's and the R that has lost its serif. Interesting, eh, Mr. Windibank?
What's all this fantastic talk? If you can catch this Hosmer Angel, catch him. Let me know when you've done it.
Certainly. Watson, will you lock the door, please?
What? Lock it?
Mr. Windibank, I have caught Hosmer Angel.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, come. This won't do. It really won't. It's only too clear.
Confound you, Mr. Sherlock Holmes. It isn't actionable.
No, I'm very much afraid that it isn't. But between ourselves, it was about as mean a trick as I ever met in my life.
Well, I say, Holmes, what's all this about? What do you mean?
I mean, Watson, that my fairy story is about a wicked stepfather who had 100 a year only so long as his wife's daughter stayed with him. He was terrified lest she'd get married someday. So he begins by denying her any form of entertainment where she might possibly meet personable young men. And when he discovers that that won't work forever...
He becomes a personable young man himself, upon my soul.
Just so, with the connivance of his wife, who seems to be as mean as he is, he adopts characteristics exactly opposite to his own. A soft voice, tinted glasses to cover his bright eyes, meets her only in the dark.
It's a joke. It was only a joke at first.
Oh, really, was it? To make a fool of that poor, simple girl, win her confidence and her love, make her swear on the testament that she'd always be true to you, and then, when your own continual visits to France became too much trouble, to take her to the very door of the church, Mr. Windibank, and then conveniently disappear by that old trick of stepping into one door of a four-wheeler and out of the other.
By Jove, Holmes!
You sicken me, Windibank. Why, you knew perfectly well she'd never forget that one romance of hers. You knew she was tied to you for at least 10 years to come by the tragedy of Hosmer Angel's disappearance. And all for the sake of £100 a year, you greedy wretch.
All right. It may be so, or it may not. But it's you that's breaking the law, and not me. As long as you keep that door locked, your ears are open to an action for illegal restraint.
Unlock it, Watson. No, the law can't touch you, Windibank. You're quite right there. But if that poor girl, Mary Sutherland, had a brother or a friend, he ought to lay a horse whip across your miserable shoulders. By Jove, I've half a mind to...
So have I, Holmes. Confound it.
Here's my hunting crop.
No, no, you can't. Here, leave me. Take it out of me. I'll have the law on you.
Let him go, Watson. He really isn't worth a charge for assault.
Upon my life, the fellow positively made me ill, Holmes. Of all the scoundrelly tricks.
Just so, my dear fellow. I suspected it from the start, of course. And when I got his letter confirming our appointment tonight...
Typed, of course.
On the very machine that Angel's letters have been written on to disguise his own handwriting, which she'd have known, of course.
What a cowardly trick, eh, Watson?
Oh, but Mary Holmes, Miss Sutherland, what are you going to say to her?
I've decided, Watson, that this is a case in which I shall have to disappoint my client. What can one tell her? If I gave her the truth, she wouldn't believe it. There's a Persian saying, there is danger for him who taketh the tiger cub, and danger also for whoso snatches a delusion from a woman. We must leave poor Mary with her memory of Hosmer.
And so ended the tragedy of the gas fitter's ball.
Lovely flow, Mary.
Lovely, Hosmer.
Lovely band, Mary.
Lovely, Hosmer. I wish it could go on and on forever, Hosmer. Just on forever. On and on.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes on Tuned to Yesterday from January 23, 1955 on NBC. So closing this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday, be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in.